السلام عليكم ورحمة الله بيتر.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Good to see you.
الحمد لله, doing great. Yeah, doing great. Really nice to chat again.
Peter, I'm really happy to have you on my podcast. Again, this podcast, Muslim Makers, is usually in French. I usually record French professionals and people in France to share their journey and what they do, and so that they can give us some of their experience. But today, I'm starting a short series of people from all around the world, especially in Western countries, but in other countries as well. And the idea, again, I explained to that in the first recording, the first interview I did last week, but it's not out yet. It's going to be out, inshallah, in a couple of days from now. The primary idea is to share to the French audience what's happening around the world, give them some other perspective of how Muslims are organized around the world, what they do, what's happening, because you're probably not aware, but France is very limited by the language barrier. A lot of what's happening around the world doesn't get to France, to the Muslim, French Muslims. So very happy to have you again. What time is it right now for you? There is a lot of time difference.
Yeah, so it's kind of late afternoon. And usually Australia, because of this, the way the time zones are set up is kind of ahead. So the joke is usually that you know, the future is safe because it's always tomorrow in Australia for most people. So yeah, it's a Wednesday afternoon and probably early, maybe Wednesday for you, or late Tuesday, depending on where you are.
It's early Wednesday, almost 9 a.m. That's good.
Great, great.
So, Peter, to start, would you like to make a short introduction of who you are? Where do you come from? What do you do? Real quickly.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Well, firstly, thanks so much for having me. Really great to connect with you. And I really enjoyed our last meeting. So it's wonderful to be on your podcast and connect with everyone listening. Thank you for taking the time. Very grateful to be with your host here. And it's, you know, looking forward to our conversation. So yes, alhamdulillah, my name is Peter. Also have the Muslim name Yasin, but I usually use, you know, Peter day to day, as that's been, you know, sort of my convention for since when I became Muslim, which was about 20 years ago. So I was 20 at that time. Now I'm 41, a few more gray hairs, a few more children, and definitely, you know, lots of things I've learned, and alhamdulillah, it's been quite a journey. So what I usually am based in Sydney, Australia, but I have lived in Dubai for a little while and San Francisco in California. Day to day, I guess you could say, you know, I'm a pretty busy hands-on father, you know, and I'm, you know, very grateful where I live, you know, that, you know, being close to my family and our community here in Sydney. But a lot of my time, of course, goes into building creative projects, design studio related projects. So I've run a design consulting firm for over 20 years now, actually before I was Muslim. And in that time, I've been able to do lots of different kinds of creative projects around the world. Mm-hmm. Before I became interested in Islam, I knew too much about it. I was a graphic designer in the early days of the kind of dot-com, early internet sort of era, I guess you'd call it, building websites, things like that, you know, 20 years ago. And then over the last, you know, really 10, 15 years, more and more my professional journey in design and creative practice has been more directly aligned, inshallah, with my spiritual path and aspirations to, you know, really understand and apply Islamic concepts directly to design and creative work. And I've also worked on a few different products, the client projects, of course, but also a range of products, some of which have, I believe, sold very well in France, actually, I found out. So that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we might talk to it a bit later again. Thank you, Peter. I think a lot of French people are fascinated about Australia. Many people want to go there for vacation or for working holidays or for whatever. But it's often a challenge because it's so far. It's such a long journey to come to Australia. My audience might wonder, what's the situation of Muslims in Australia? Is it a big population? How are there? Do you have messages? Do you have Muslims? Like, can you talk to us about the situation of Muslims there?
Absolutely. All questions welcome, and inshallah, you're all welcome. Anyone listening, I do hope you're able to join us here. We are quite far away from Europe, and from a lot of places, unless you're maybe in Asia somewhere. So I appreciate that, sometimes we do feel like a distant planet even, or a bit of a imaginary place, but it is a real country. There are people that live here. Alhamdulillah for in fact, Australia has a very fascinating history. It has a very, very deep and rich tradition with an indigenous Australian population, and is an incredible conversation we can have around that. What is also fascinating in this context is the Australian indigenous connection to Islam, which I didn't actually know about or learn about until I was Muslim and then exploring this topic with certain projects and organizations and a museum actually. I'll share a little bit about that because I think I've found it quite fascinating,
Oh,
and to be
interesting.
honest, not too many people know about it. So a kind of brief version, if you like, is quite some time before European settlement. So the British came here. We were kind of a British colony. The Europeans came in the late 18th century, but at least 100 years before that, maybe more, maybe several hundred years, we're not too sure. There were traders from our northern neighbor, which is kind of present day Indonesia or Malaysia. Previously, you might have called it Malaya, but areas known as kind of Makassar or the Makassans would actually sail down and travel down, carrying, carried by certain currents and ocean seasonal winds, I believe, to the northern part of Australia and trade, and over time build these relationships with the indigenous Australian population in the very north of the country. And there's all kinds of different fascinating stories and evidence from this, again, long before European settlement. I was very fortunate to visit and meet a number of the people connected with those stories and paths, and there's different kind of artifacts and even rock art you see of Macassan boats that I was able to visit and see and photograph as part of a project, for example, with the Islamic Museum in Australia. So we have an Islamic Museum in Melbourne, one of our big cities. So it's actually, there's quite a rich and deep history there. Another part of Australian Muslim history that's also quite fascinating is sometime later, so after really the colony, which grew into a small Commonwealth nation, if you like. Over some time, as the sort of country was expanding, sort of modern day Australia as we think of it, the there were certain geographical challenges that, if you can think of what you think of when you think Australia, the kind of nature, particularly the outback part, which is in the central part of the country, was very difficult for very difficult terrain to explore. So as people were trying to, expand, build, further and further agriculture or, settlement further and deeper into the country, horses don't go well in the desert. But the British kind of, I guess, empire looked at, this is a very simplified version, but kind of looked at where else in the empire at that time they had, desert dwelling, culture, and basically what we think of as modern day Afghanistan, Pakistan, people from what are now known as the Cameleers were basically brought here to Australia, and all these camels and the Muslim, if you like, handlers of these camels were brought all throughout parts of Australia, and they helped open up the roads, the telegraph wires, and eventually the train lines, and they would deliver the mail and the water and supplies. And there's all these fantastic little stories all throughout. This is sort of the pre before before trains really were all across the country. There's all these stories. So you can go to right to the heart of Australia, in the middle of the most kind of iconic desert, if you like, fully outback, and you will find Muhammad Street, Saadeddine Street. You'll find that there's a very famous railway that comes right across the desert now, called the Ghan. And the Ghan is, you know, directly, and the little icon, the brand, or the, you know, if you like, is a cameleer. So one of these, you know, with a big turban and clearly from this heritage that, and they, the most fascinating part of that to me is that they left a whole series of these very beautiful little tin mosques and little almost kind of like mud brick style mosques. Very, very simple that almost you could imagine might have been at the time of the very early days of Medina, for example. You know, these very simple structures with palm trees and so on. These exist in the middle of Australia. So, you
You
know,
still
you I went to one.
find them?
Yeah, you still find them, and you know, fortunately, quite a few have been restored and respected by the locals and preserved, which is quite wonderful, really. And you can visit even one today from 1862. I went to, and it was quite amazing to think. But many Australians don't really know this part of history, and I guess it's part of, you know, part of our role is to share that if we're aware of it.
Great. So what about the current situation of Muslims? What's the situation of Muslims right now? Are they based in big cities? What's the percentage of the Muslim population in general? Is it growing? Do you have a lot of masajids? Or are you well implemented? Implemented, yes.
So basically, from much later after that time, you have particularly, you know, in the sort of 20th century, you have different waves of migration, particularly the latter part, and you have really this incredible diversity. So within Australia, I think you have 100+ Muslim cultures, if you like. So there's actually every kind of, it's like a little microcosm of the Ummah sometimes, which is fascinating. And depending on where you are, mostly concentrated in the cities like Sydney and Melbourne. You'll see these very diverse communities, and quite a few of them are, I guess you'd say, particularly, you know, in the previous few decades were, you know, organized around, you know, traditional migration kind of pattern where you'd have certain communities. So let's say my local mosque actually is Bosnian, so you know
Oh,
a lot of the Bosnian
interesting.
community set up here. But if you go to a Jummah on a Friday, it's very diverse. You have a lot of people from, say, Arab or Lebanese background. There's a lot of Lebanese Australians in Sydney in particular. But you'll have Indonesians. You, again, think of the proximity. And you'll have, you know, in this increasing mix. One of the mosques that I visited before I was Muslim was a very, very beautiful Ottoman-style Turkish mosque in Sydney, and it looks like a tiny, tiny slice of Ottoman history in the middle of Australia that the Turkish community did an amazing job establishing. And so it's basically what you find is quite a mix, which is quite wonderful, I think. Percentage wise, it's still quite small. It's probably between 2 and 5% of the global of the you know the national population. But Australia has a population of around 30 million people, so you can sort of do the math there. That's where we are. We do definitely have plenty of mosques. We have a lot of Islamic schools. By and large, because of this, you know, such a diverse group of Muslims, you have, you know, lots of Muslims that are professionals. You have lots of students internationally that come. And one thing we have surprisingly is we have, particularly in the cities, a lot of halal food because Australia actually exports a lot of its meat to Indonesia, the Gulf region. So it just so happens, even though you're a small population, you might have a you'll have, you know, where I live, for example, most of the pretty much things like lamb or chicken is probably going to be halal, or you know, quite a lot of it, even if the people eating there aren't fully aware of it, or you could look at the certificate if you ask. So overall, it's quite a you know, depending on who you ask. Obviously, there's been plenty of issues over the years. That's probably your next question. It's like how, you know, what's the experience like? The situation is, yeah. I mean, why don't you go ahead and ask, and then I'll share.
I didn't, I wasn't about to ask the question, but as you give me the as proposed me to ask this question, like what's the is there how are the different communities? You said that there are so many different communities in Australia. Do they work together as one community, or can you see that they are like very specific community working within themselves, within their groups? That's one thing. And the second thing is that do you see that the state of Islam in in Australia is growing, is getting better and better over the years, or is it stagnating, or is it challenging?
Yeah, I would say there's a quite a few complex parts to that to unpack, and you know, you could probably do this podcast with 100 different Australian Muslims and get all sorts of, you know, di quite different perspectives on things. I have, I guess, an interesting journey through, you know, being the first, you know, first 20 years of my life in, you know, kind of suburban southern Sydney, as you know, just growing up as a teenager here and doing a lot of normal stuff, you know, for people like me. And then, but then, you know, and I didn't have a lot of contact with Islam and Muslims during that time. And then, really, you know, the 20 years since, getting to know so many parts of the Australian Muslim community has been quite, you know, quite wonderful and fantastic. But there's definitely complexity. There are all kinds of different issues. There has, I think, definitely been, you know, strong streaks of racism that a lot of people will report, particularly when you have heightened times of Islamophobia. You know, unfortunately, always women get targeted more. You know, visibly Muslim people might have that experience more, and especially, you know, difficult times around. I'm sure you're well aware of the, you know, the peak times when that might have been happening with global events and headlines. But I also see a lot of more promising things. If I'm more of a optimist, glass half full kind of person, where I see a lot of genuine success from younger Muslim professionals, from, you know, businesses that have established and become, you know, well known here, from more Muslims in government, more Muslims in different kind of sectors and places. So just having that presence really, I think, has helped a lot. And you find a lot of, you find more incidental Muslim, you know, characters in, you know, popular culture or TV shows or advertising. All of these things help, you know. But yeah, look, I think we still got a long way to go. You know, I wouldn't want to paint too rosy a picture, but I'm optimistic. And some of the things that I saw 20 years ago, I think, have really improved. But you know, it's in my experience, and I think quite a few of my friends, you know, who are from quite different cultural backgrounds, some of them are, you know, hijab women, wearing women. I generally have had, I think, reports that things are better than they might have been some years ago.
Great. So, let's now talk about your main expertise, design, and what how did design become so important to you, and how did you connect that to your faith, and how do you th what do you think it's so linked to faith?
Yeah, well, big and favorite topic here now. So I think from a young age I was interested in different kinds of creative practice, and also quite interested in technology. So early kind of computers, and interested in digital art from a young age. I didn't really know sort of design necessarily as a practice or a discipline or even a profession, what exactly that kind of meant. But I definitely had a love for graphic design. So, you know, from early kind of computers, and, you know, playing around with things like Photoshop in the early 90s or mid 90s, I really felt, wow, this is very exciting. You know, it's a place where, and this is early internet era, you know, long before social media, but definitely where you're able to, you know, create art. You're able to, you know, combine, you know, visual communication using digital tools. And it was a pretty exciting era to, you know, be a young person in. And I kind of, I guess, was so enthusiastic about that, but, you know, that people around me could see that, and ended up, you know, kind of doing very basic projects, and eventually freelancing, where people was like, hey, can you help me with this? Can you design that? That kind of grew into like, hey, I need a website. Do you know how to do that? You know, do I need, you know, tell me about, you know, branding or designing identity or designing some kind of poster. So back at that time, you know, in my late teens, I started actually freelancing and earning, you know, pretty reasonable income. I also worked at McDonald's for a short time, and quickly realized that I think I can do much better with my graphic design career than working here. But it gave me an appreciation for lots of things, and entrepreneurship, you know, over time. So initially, it was really a love and of the potential for visual communication, and over time, that really grew into needing to understand what the clients need, what the project needs, rather than just, you know, how do we make something look great or look visually appealing or effective. But what's actually going to be helpful for a client project to, change a condition or communicate something. And then as I got further into that, it was really trying to understand strategy and what do how do people react to things? What are how do you start optimizing and researching so that what you are designing actually solves a problem and solves it well and eventually delightfully? Or what are the things that the world needs that a customer might be where you can kind of meet at the intersection of people, products, and design strategy. So I felt more and more in that place. I was able to grow my practice from just one person to, eventually, 20 people in different countries, and doing lots of kind of great projects. Where I think my faith came in played an increasingly important role. So I'd started freelancing a little bit, from that young age, but after I became Muslim, I was very curious about what is the kind of Muslim understanding of design? What is the creative legacy, or even, very clearly there's this stunning visual heritage. Everyone, even if you're not really into design, you're probably aware of, beautiful Islamic calligraphy or places like the Alhambra or the Blue Mosque. You're aware of something special about these places. They're super popular even as tourist destinations. So I went on a bit of a quest to basically every time I could do enough projects to save up and fund a trip, I would fly myself back to somewhere like Syria or Turkey or Jordan or Morocco, where I'd studied Arabic for a while and was in this state for some years of exploration, research, asking. And what I immediately started to realize that the type of graphic design and type of product design I'd been taught was really very commercial, very business driven, very enterprising. It's really about selling things and, in many cases, digital products to grab attention. But what I love so much about, these Islamic design kind of approach and Islamic art was it was really designed for remembrance. It was designed for inviting you to contemplate and to think of the divine and to be in a space of presence and appreciate beauty in an experiential way, not
So
just to
when
kind
you
of
talk about
distract.
design, when you talk about design, sorry, now it's a more, I mean, you talk mostly about the architecture of the buildings and masajids in those countries, right?
That's right, but also just it could be certain objects. So it could be the way that certain surface is tiled, or the way that calligraphy. If you go to places in different parts of the Islamic world. Even I went to China, for example, and got to see mosques in Beijing, where they had a very different calligraphy style. So Khat Sini, the Chinese style, but very very Chinese, but also very Islamic in its message. And I appreciated there was a phrase from one of my teachers quoting a scholar who says that Islam is like this clear water that flows around the planet, and wherever it flows, it reflects the colors of the bedrock under which it is seen. So that's why in China, for example, Islam looks Chinese. If you go to Turkey, of course, Istanbul, you see that very distinct style, and so on. So as I started to travel more and more, I was interviewing more scholars and creative professionals and meeting people on this path of curiosity about what is Islamic design and what does that mean today? So we may not be able to, sit for 20 hours and prepare our calligraphy, read and sit and, kind of meditate with, preparing, like the way people might have in the past. But what are some principles and aspirations we can have as contemporary designers, professionals, and later entrepreneurship as I started to get further into the path of, design, innovation, and working with startups, is trying to see what from these traditional understandings we can apply today.
What do you think is the what do you think the Islamic design is? What's the value added of Islamic design? What can it bring? What of positive? Why do you think it's so important?
Well, to me, Islamic design is all about design for remembrance, bringing you to that place of seeking God and bringing you not about the individual artists who might have worked on that, but to bring you to a place of contemplation and ultimately to a place of surrender and peace and understanding Beautiful, and I think even simple Islamic art does that. It's very it can be transformative in affect someone's spiritual state, just by these secrets of understanding this traditional design. And I think in but how do you the question becomes, how do you apply that today when you're busy, you've got deadlines, you've got deliverables. You might ha work in a place where you're like, we need to get, these marketing deadlines, done. We need to reach, social media content every 30 seconds. We need more and more, more. So it's challenging. But I think there are certain understandings that I feel like I've arrived at, from these years of exploring and learning that we should aspire to. And so, of course, looking even at our intentionality, understanding Ania, that's not always done, even in, popular design practice. It's not always looked at more deeply, understanding your, there's a big role that design has in terms of the responsibility, in terms of you're dealing with not just a person, but that person has a spiritual state. And at the deepest level, it's, especially as a designer or a creative person, it's trying to be aware that, we're not humans having a spiritual experience, where spiritual beings having a human experience, and that changes your design perspective. It elevates your questions, and you feel the amana, the trust of, if I'm in a position to influence how a product is made or how some kind of creative experience is designed, you've got to be careful. You've got to be responsible with what you're doing.
Yes. In terms of design, we see like in some, I'm gonna come back to the Western parts a bit later, but from what you have seen and what I have seen during our travels, you have nowadays beautiful historical messages or buildings, architectures, and even nowadays in many Arab countries or in African countries, many message beautiful, very beautiful messages are built. But do you think that, I feel that sometimes the spirit of what it's supposed to be is a bit lost, because when you go to this message, it's very empty, seems very dry, but it still have beautiful design. So how do you reconcile those two elements?
Yeah, I think it takes a lot more than even the most beautiful design spaces. There's a lot more that is required in this age, and I think for all ages, of course, to get to that place. And I think it's important that the spaces are beautiful and take their cultural context into account. But it's a much bigger question, really, about the individuals and their own journey and their own seeking. I mean, one way I like to think about this, again, through a little through the lens of design perspective, is thinking about what we might be doing as an interface or a window to invite people to get back to seeking God, or exploring a spiritual path, or taking that more seriously. And what I mean by that is, if we think of, we're in a world of right now, and I have three kids, two teenagers, and it's quite fascinating the journey that they're in a world of digital content, digital experiences. They're in a world where the most influential things that, if you let them, or people, in the age bracket, it'll be, 4 second TikToks, or it'll be like, doom scrolling, reel after reel, or it'll be, video games that will just go forever, and Netflix, play next episode. And I'm, rather than me pushing back against all of those things, saying avoid them, avoid them, that's not my approach. I say that be aware of them, be aware that the design intent of those things is usually addiction. A lot of the, especially, digital apps, they're designed for addiction. They're designed for attention. And what we can do is still embrace the digital tools and platforms, but and video games, for example, or great online content, great beautiful social media that's meaningful with good intent, great media, and animated series, film series. I believe we should be investing heavily into making those, but in a more wholesome way, and designing again for remembrance rather than just distraction. That is where, and then maybe you'll see more people in those beautiful mosques, inshallah, you know. But I do, I'm also aware that I think there is a sometimes, it's probably a crude analogy, but sometimes I say, and I see that here in Australia as well, for example, there's an overinvestment into what you might call the hardware, but not the software, meaning you might have an amazing space, facility, you know, it's incredible, you know, mosque, but yeah, go there at Maghreb and there'll be like 12 people there, right? Maybe not. I mean, you know, but the software is, you know, the people, the inspiration, the programming, the culturally relevant programming that meets people where they are, that is inclusive, that is designed to understand the cultural context of the day, the language of the day. And that's where I think there's enormous responsibility for people that, you know, are in roles of influence, can maybe consider designing creative content, designing, it could be, you know, a book, you know, beautiful books or comics, digital content, games. I mean, there's a lot we can do there. And that's, I think, been a big part of my last 20 years is exploring how we can do that and what can we design that may you know, shift the conversation to the direction that I think the world needs.
Yes. I have two questions. I'm thinking about which one I should ask first. All right, let's go back to the design, Islamic design in Western countries. I guess that's the countries that are lacking a lot of appropriation of their own design, right? You shared when we last met a couple of months ago. You shared to me this very nice article called "Islam and the Cultural Imperative." I forgot the name of the author. Maybe you remember.
Yes, Dr. Omar Farouk Abdallah is the
Thank
author.
you, thank you. And I had a look into it, and it looks it looked it was really striking. I thought it was so obvious. You already mentioned that earlier, but when you go to China, the mosques looks Chinese. When you go to countries in Africa, in Algeria, in Morocco, the mosque looks Moroccan, and so on in various countries. But when you go to Europe, or when you go to North America, and presumably also in Australia, what you would find is either very simple, almost no design, like a building, or you would find like imported design from those Arab countries or Eastern countries. Can you come back a little bit, maybe summarize this concept, this article really quickly, and tell us why is it important for us in Western countries to really embrace our Muslim identity and build, I mean, create build our Muslim identity and design in those places.
Yeah, look, I think I'll share a little story and then I'll come back to that. So, you know, after I became Muslim in Australia, you know, I was feeling inwardly, you know, quite at peace at the you know, at a foundational level, you know, really feeling this incredible in what you might call sakina, that you know, you feel like, you know, a veil has been lifted. You've unlocked this you know, this deep, simple truth that, you know, having this sense of tawakkul and, you know, reliance on God as a profound you know, mindset that, you know, guides your daily affairs is just so reassuring and beautiful if, you know, if you're able to be in that place of remembrance. But outwardly, you know, in terms of my kind of cultural journey, if you like, or my identity, you know, I was feeling a bit lost because, you know, there were different kind of Muslim groups. I would go to the Bosnian mosque, or I'd go to, you know, what are probably more Lebanese or, you know, Arab mosques, if you like. At that time, it was felt a little bit more siloed, and this is not unusual, as we know, in a lot of probably European or North American context. And I was struggling a little bit to go, what is kind of the Australian Muslim identity? What is it? What isn't it? I'm not sure. At that time, I ended up, for different reasons, moving to California for a little while, and San Francisco in particular. And what I found there was Islam, at least the kind of circles that I was connected to, was quite a bit more established in terms of what you might call homegrown English speaking scholars, people that had learned from teachers that were, Californian, who had, embraced Islam at some point, studied the tradition, deeply, and in many cases in centers of learning like maybe Mauritania or Syria or, Yemen, Tarim. But the students around those people and the influence they had was bringing this truth and this spiritual wisdom and the teachings that, are authentic and deeply connected through, through the scholars and the Sanad, but in a context that was very Western. And so I had this moment, for example, where I remember early, I was not too long after I landed in California, someone that I kind of got to know briefly said, "Hey, why don't you come over to my place this evening? I have a few friends around." I'm like, "Yeah, great, great." And then at one point, he turns all the lights off and goes, "Okay, guys, all right, just hang on." I was like, he goes, "Get ready." I'm like, "What is happening? What's going to happen here?" And all of a sudden, the guy, turns on his collectible Star Wars lightsaber collection. And suddenly the room lights up with these cool, super, bright colored lightsabers. And I'm, my geek background loves Star Wars, right? And I'm like, "Oh, wow." So this guy's like very Muslim, very knowledgeable. He knows Arabic well, he's learned it, but he also loves Star Wars. And suddenly have this little simple moment of like, "Oh, that's there's nothing wrong with being both of those things." And as I spent more time in California, for example, I was like, there's more and more things that I felt just because of the way I grew up, the kind of influence I had, the kind of from whether it's from fashion to even music, parts of it, more conscious hip hop, for example, things that I connected with, I felt culturally then at ease. So coming back to Australia, and I saw more and more of this change. Where I was going with all of that, and just that simple story is, I think the article addresses the importance and relevance of not just divorcing your faith from, its context of who you are, your identity, and the things that have made up your path and your tradition, and as long as those things are not really having negative effects or pulling you away from those fundamentals in Islam, then it can be such a beautiful, enriching thing. You have that diversity. I mean, one of the coolest things about being Muslim is you can go to pretty much anywhere in the world, almost any country, any pocket of the world, if you find a place of worship, you find a mosque. You will have this rapport immediately. You'll have this set of rituals and understandings. You can pray together. You will probably know a bunch of surahs together. There's this beautiful, and if Muslims, I think sometimes don't appreciate that, that beautiful, you might call unity, but not uniformity, right? That we have this unity, even though it doesn't always might not look like that, and not really politically, perhaps, but unity in those basic tenets of faith, very powerful and very empowering and enriching. But that diversity that we have, like when I visited that mosque in Beijing, being able to have that beautiful understanding immediately, even if there's language barriers. So the article goes into that, but in much more technical detail as well, in terms of understanding the fiqh and understanding the scholarly approach to this. So I can give you the fun examples with Star Wars. What Dr. Omar there is doing is giving you, the much, I think, more scholarly understanding of why this is important. And I'd encourage anyone to read it. I think it's been out for some years, like perhaps even, I don't know, maybe even 20 years or, at least 15 years, but it's quoted time and again by many people that I respect.
My next question is, so we talked about the imperative of creating our own Muslim identity in Western countries. Is that something that you are aiming to in your work? Like, is that for you like a North Star, something that you're trying to grow? Well, what's your own vision with design?
Yeah, I come back to this idea that I think we have an opportunity, and I think of it as an amana, really, like a trust that if we've been given these great opportunities and tools and technologies and platforms and even just, good Wi-Fi that works and good coffee that keeps us, kind of, warm, then, this is already more than so many people on the planet that are, are not gifted those things, to have other kinds of blessings. But we have, particularly in Western countries, in Australia, US, UK, we have incredible platforms and opportunities, and I think a big amana to help in different ways. And of course, many traditional ways are things like through charitable activities, through all kinds of things that I think Muslims are really active in doing, in terms of for example, supporting the difficult refugee situations around the world, all kinds of, through things like zakat and, Eid activities. But I think what we have is a much bigger opportunity and a responsibility to design using the language and tools of the day, which for me is digital content and digital products and interfaces. And, that may include things like VR and AR, or embracing AI, with real concern and guidelines and guardrails, especially something like AI, rather than turning away from technology just at a fundamental level. I think it is being curious about those things, having con being in the conversation, designing experiments, and getting feedback from scholars and, knowledgeable people about things we're building. That to me extends to things like products and brands, and using like consumer understanding of kind of like consumer goods, but trying to do that in a responsible and holistic way. Look, not looking at success of just how much can I sell, how much money I can make. That is the paradigm we need to break. It's like how meaningful and how much impact can I have on either suppliers I'm working with or the team that I'm hiring, trying to bring these values of Nia and working with towards Ahsan in what we do, not just the product, but in the team and the culture, working with sincerity and ikhlas. I think that's what I would love to try to be a part of, is bringing back what this traditional understanding was. It's not just, rushing more junk out and selling something with Islam on the label and saying, yeah, it's Islamic. No, but really looking at, well, what traditionally made something more, inspired by Islam? What can we apply from that into the modern world? And that's not to say we're always going to get it right. But I don't think we should just sit back and watch our young people just be completely addicted to, consumer lifestyles and fast fashion and, highly addictive and sometimes dangerous apps. We need to be in the conversation, and I think we need to create not just alternatives, I think that's not, always the right word, but create sometimes the leading products and services that universally people can benefit from and appreciate. And doesn't even have to necessarily be packaged in something that says Islam or for Muslims at all. I think sometimes some of the best products and ideas will take those values and bring them to life, and universally will be beneficial. That's my long and complex North Star, if you like.
That's interesting. Don't you think that something that comes to my mind, I'm just asking, like, because the technology is evolving so fast and faster actually, don't you think that it might be sometimes misleading, in a sense that you have to jump, you have to always be in the forefront, so have to jump from one technology to another each time. Is that something that you think we're supposed to be in each time in the forefront, or maybe to take a step back and decide where we want to have an implication?
Yeah, I think the I think you want people that are in those pioneering roles. For example, we hosted and have had a number of sessions about AI and Islam, my studio here, and globally, different groups and networks I'm connected to, with some Muslims really at the forefront of researching that. And but also the ones I know personally are very sincere, and they're concerned, and they're not trying to sugarcoat this potential and danger of, like, yeah, AI really having a major detrimental effect on many things we cherish. I think it's a very real concern. At the same time, there's people I trust in those roles that are connected to scholarship and are deeply, rooted in their own kind of faith and have a solid Islamic grounding. So I take reassurance when there are people like that In terms of mass adoption, well, this is the thing is, like, we can sit here and have a, great podcast conversation about it, but if some 13-year-old has their homework assignment due or their Islamic studies essay due, and ChatGPT can write it for them, well, a lot of kids might just be like, you know what, go write it for me, right? But they're not going to ask permission necessarily. I mean, I'd like to think that's not the case, but I just know that it's a real danger to the whole education system right now, and including all kinds of Islamic education is just going to be, our hand is a little bit forced, is what I kind of see, that we have to be in the conversation. But I don't want us to think like technology has all these answers. All the answers are in our tradition. All the you know we're still just as human as ever. We have the same challenges. We have the same kind of needs. We have the same kind of nafs as in the books. All these things are there for us to learn, and we want to be on that path of improvement, growth, purification in our spiritual life, and be wary of technology. But I still feel like we, my personal position is we're just as Muslim communities a little too conservative and a too much on the receiving end. And before we know it, like a classic example of, gosh, how many parents I know are like, man, my, kids I know, they just want to play Fortnite. They just want to sit and watch this show. I'm like, yeah, but you know what? Like, for the last 5, 10 years, who has been making the games and making the shows and putting the millions into Netflix? And then occasionally you'll have a breakout success like Ertugrul, right, which became globally popular. That's like one of the few examples where, media has been done in that kind of more wholesome way. If we just had another 100 of those and, 100 great video games, I think, that stuff's really important. But we need to change our mindset, support those kind of projects, encourage people to, be into design, spiritually grounded, but create these kind of experiences. That's what's been really lacking, that kind of, enthusiasm to all this curiosity to support things that are well-intentioned, well-designed.
Would you mind sharing a few examples of well-designed tools or examples of object or anything that supports the Muslim community and anyone else which is designed as you mentioned?
So the phrase I use a lot is what I call heart-centered design. So isn't necessarily just purely kind of Islamic design, isn't necessarily just for Muslims, it's for people. Sometimes it's by Muslims for everyone, which is, I think, a great approach as well. For example, where we met Abdurrahman in Bali was partly created from a platform called LaunchGood. I think LaunchGood are a really good example. If you haven't come across them, launchgood.com basically are a Islamic, or you call a crowdfunding site for Muslim projects. And it's had a tremendous success. They've raised, I think, nearly $400 million since they started. And it's a great platform for doing good, supporting good, entrepreneurially. There's charity, community projects, and have a great design team. The product, if you go on their app, for example, it has a good UX. It really encourages people to do good and donate more. They might have a simple thing like join Friday Givers. So I've been since the beta project of Friday Givers, I don't even care, remember what the amount is, but every week automatically, I have an amount that's donated every Friday to a great cause that they pick, that's the cause of the week. That's such a simple little thing, but I know for the last, gosh, probably at least 5 years, every Friday, a small donation is made automatically, and that's a great design experience. And I think there should be a lot more examples like that. There's a few, but that's one of my favorites.
I remember one of the examples that you gave, and I think that's the one that worked a lot in France. Was it the brand was Zilch or something like that? The
Yeah,
little puppet.
we made a brand called Five Pillars. I remember how you spell it in French, but it's basically we did it in a few different languages, and it became, I remember it
Sanctuary.
being quite popular. And it sold really well in France, and in COVID we had to pause production and a few things changed because of the global shipping. But I that's one of my favorite. It's a simple example. It's just a board, it's a board game, but it's well designed, it's visually appealing. And a board game is nice because it's a great way for family or community to come together. You don't need any apps, devices, any Wi-Fi. You can just sit down face to face, play a board game. But it's all around Islamic trivia and Islamic content. And there's different levels, different versions. We made junior edition for kids. We made complex, editions, a Sierra edition. There's travel. There's a fun box where there's this different kind of fun activities like charade style or Pictionary, where you have to draw. And it's a fun way to learn. It's just a good way of I think using potential of design, understanding the problem. So the root problem there isn't just like, hey, we need another game. The root problem is like parents and people are looking for they realize the importance of Islamic knowledge and having that traditional spiritual wisdom in our lives. But lectures aren't necessarily working. Madrasa Islamic school isn't necessarily working. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if kids are enjoying this board game and they want to play it more and more, which is what I'd seen, then that's solving the same problem, which is education or teaching kind of Islamic concepts, but in a much more fun way. And it's not really wouldn't replace traditional learning, but definitely it complements that. It's using design-led thinking to support that same objective. And so I'd like to think more and more we should be designing again the same problems, the same issues we're trying to solve, but there's lots of creative ways to do that.
Great. We are reaching the end of the interview, Peter. I still have a few smaller questions to ask, but before that, do you have anything to add? Something that maybe you wish that we mentioned or we might have forgot to mention?
Look, I think my problem is I can talk too much. I had a nice coffee just before we started, and the caffeine is still there. So no, why don't you go ahead and ask, and I'd love
Good.
to explore.
Great. So, what's the most important skill or the few most important skills that you use in your day-to-day activity?
I think for myself, but anyone listening, hopefully, is let's develop what I might call a designer mindset or even an entrepreneurial mindset. It doesn't mean you have to be a designer or a professional designer or a startup founder or someone, who's going to drop everything and start a business, but bring a curiosity and a creative approach to the problems and frustrations you have. And they might be lots of things. There might be things in your immediate life or your career, community problems, ummah problems, planetary problems. There's no shortage. I would say find the ones that, or one even that, you feel so compelled to, you need to work on this. This is something you can do, and bring your creative designer mindset, which is reframes that from a problem to a challenge, where it's like, oh man. My local mosque, they have a problem with, I don't know, let's say they use always plastic everywhere, plastic cups, so many plastic waste, whatever. That's a problem. The designer, if you reframe that as a design challenge, you say, well, how might we reduce plastic in my local mosque? How might we make it fun to recycle at the mosque? Right. And maybe there's so many simple things you can do. Maybe there's a little challenge for people, maybe someone sponsors it. There's so many creative ways you can do that. And our entrepreneurial mindset is looking at how we can use innovation and commercial perspective to solve problems as well. And I think that's a great tool for change that we would do well as an ummah to embrace more as our, earliest examples in the Sahaba did with mercantile activity is that it's at the heart of our tradition, and I think we shouldn't shy away from embracing that, but seeing success in a holistic and wholesome way. Success is not just how much did you earn, but what kind of change you were able to affect, what kind of lives you were able to help transform, or if even if not that, just living in a sustainable halal income. in a world with a lot of difficult influences, that's a very beautiful thing.
Fantastic. I think your day-to-day life is might be very 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 busy. So how do you what are your routines? How do you rejuvenate yourself? How what are your daily or weekly routines to to keep high energy and to progress?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, and I don't want to pretend I'm some superhuman that is just having this incredible high performance lifestyle all the time. At the end of the day, I try where I can to put my family first in terms of being there every morning for my kids. You're doing things like school drop or helping with breakfast, and in evenings being present. As I get older, like just knowing that is the value of that in an age of digital distraction, that human kind of connection is still increasingly just so important to just to kind of be there and have these that presence. Like on the weekend, I was playing some board games with my son, for example, and the default in this age is still digital entertainment, digital everything. So it's nice to do that. I think, though, I'm very fortunate that I have a great team. I've developed a great team. I have good partners I work with that give me energy. Very fortunate to have a nice studio space that's close to the beach here in Sydney. One of the reasons I love, living in Sydney is that, it's for a lot of the cities are very coastal. But also, I really try to get create community events and have different kind of meetups, for example, where I invite different entrepreneurs, different creatives or different kind of leaders to come to my studio, give small talks to, groups of people that are interested in whatever that topic is. For example, next week we have one with a founder here in Australia who, raised, one of the largest investment rounds in Australia, has a super successful unicorn company, but it's so humble and so chill. And so many people don't just see him as a guy from the Moth. They don't actually realize. I get energy from those kind of things. I appreciate not everyone does, but it's just, I guess my personality is keeping that momentum. But also just feeling aligned. You want your spiritual aspirations to be aligned with your work. So you don't feel like, I know that's a simple thing to say, hard thing to do, and not every work day is this, it's not like some sort of angelic experience where you just always fully, feel like every moment is fully aligned. But I think coming back to those basics and really looking at our work and saying, is this aligned with what I want to be doing? Or, if right now it's difficult, am I taking steps to get closer? And inshallah, like keep making that intention, keep finding ways to get closer to that alignment where you are feeling aligned, where your work and your daily activity aligns with your purpose, the people around you, the culture you're in is supporting your spiritual aspirations rather than pulling you away. And if not, what are some changes there? And that's the heart of the program that I teach called The Heart of Design, which is exploring design as a spiritual practice. That's alhamdulillah what I'm able to teach and help people through that process.
I'll add that in the comment in the description section. I'm very fortunate to be able to follow your class, actually. I still have to catch up the last session, I think, due to the time zone difference. I think it's at 2 a.m. here in France, but I really appreciate your class and thank you for that. Do you have what are you do you have any recommendation of books, let's say? Of the top, let's say two, three books that you have either recently read or that have been a great inspiration for you.
Yeah, look, there's many, and you also find through the seasons of life, you have this kind of what is the right fit for your book? You're the right book for that season of life. So something that I found 20 years ago maybe like transformative would be maybe different today. So it really depends on where you're at, and I get that. One of them that I've gone back to consistently is called Living Presence by Kabir Helminski. Living Presence, I think, is a really wonderful book in English that explores, I think, it has this wonderful kind of, I'd call spiritual vocabulary that I haven't found in too many other Islamic books that just really describes. So it's about 25 years old, and it's been reissued. It's been consistently popular. So that's a beautiful one, Living Presence. There's a classic called The War of Art, not The Art of War. It's The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. That's an amazing book about overcoming resistance and sort of getting things done. Basically the nafs, the creative blocks that you might do to overcome nafs. That's a great one. And then maybe a third one called The Artist's Way, in a similar way. The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron is a really good one that helps kind of rejuvenate a sense of creativity and purpose that often gets lost in a lot of adults as they get busy in their professional lives. They kind of forget that when they're younger, there are so many the creative pursuits that they were able to do. It helps people kind of recover that path, and that might be things just like, try journaling a little bit, going for nature walks, taking artist dates. So The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron is a great one as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Peter. Last question, maybe if someone from the audience, anyone from the audience wants to follow your work, and maybe if they have a question and they want to reach out to you, is that possible?
Yeah, of course. I'd be very happy to. So you can just Google my name, Peter Gould. There's two Peter Goulds. Well, there's actually many, but the two that will come up, one of them is a Hollywood director who's very famous and has done a whole bunch of, popular shows. So I'm the other one that will come up. So I'm the Australian Muslim designer that will come up. Probably on Instagram, I try and post, a little bit what's happening. I have a newsletter where I share different activities. And LinkedIn as well. I've, try to have different conversations on LinkedIn. So any of those are good, or contact me through the site. And I hope to be able to visit you there in France sometime, inshallah.
Of course, let me know if you have the opportunity to come. I would be happy to host you, inshallah. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. I really appreciated talking with you as usual. I hope to see you again, maybe in the next GMW event. Who knows? Yeah,
Inshallah.
I ask Allah that He adds more barakah in your work, even more barakah in your work and what you do in any of your projects, and in your family and in your studio, inshallah. Thank you so much, Peter.
Inshallah. And for you and all of your listeners, inshallah. Ameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله.